Welcome to Changing the Narrative. I'm Dina Eccles. As we witness the collapse of economic systems, the rise of militarism, and the distrust of people who are different, one has to wonder what are the pathways forward. As food scarcity is crippling many, and our collective health suffers from poor nutrition, as our safety nets are disappearing due to political and economic decisions, there needs to be a reckoning of what we have allowed. My guest offers an historical account of what has led us to this moment and what means we may have to rise out of it again as healthy and whole human beings on this beloved earth. Elspeth Hay is a writer, creator, and host of the Local Food Report. It's a weekly that airs on Cape Cod's NPR station since 2008. Deeply immersed in her own local food system, she reports for print, radio, and online media with a focus on food, the environment, people, places, and ideas that feed us. She lives in Wellfleet, Massachusetts. And we're going to be discussing her newly released book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food, which I have to say I thoroughly enjoyed. I'd like to welcome you, Elspeth.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction.
Well, deserved. So your book is filled with observations and a consistent upending of beliefs that are particularly regarding farming and food that is extremely timely and I think deserves our scrutiny. So I really appreciated the read. And right out of the gate, you make a reference to Adam and Eve, which really kind of I was tied in for you with you from there on because it's something I've always been curious about, to be banished from the garden and cursed to become farmers as a punishment. How did you come to that as a beginning for your book?
You know, it's so funny. My grandfather was an Episcopal minister, and he unfortunately passed away when I was maybe 12, so I didn't get to know him as well as I would have liked. And my parents were not into religion. They were very devoutly atheist. But my grandmother still told me all the stories. And so I remember the story of the fall being one of the earliest food stories I knew. And I don't think I really thought much of it at the time. I liked the drawings of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden.
Of course.
But as I had this moment about 5 years ago where I learned that we can eat acorns, and it started really unraveling the stories I knew about food. And so one of the first things that I did was sort of take stock of the childhood stories that I learned about food. And when I went back and looked at that story, I think there was a friend who said, you know, hey, you should go back and look at that Adam and Eve story. And I was so shocked. I picked up multiple different copies of the Bible because I think I kept thinking, this must be a mistake. Like, really, our founding story is that our life as farmers is this terrible punishment from God? Like, what is going on here? And, you know, there's a lot of different interpretations of it I've heard, but I was just so surprised by that.
Yeah, and I've always taken note that it's a certain group of people that have been banished from the garden, that not all people have that creation story. You know, it's an interesting thing, but and I think it ties into your book later on. So, yeah, so that intrigued me right away, and you had me like going, okay, this is going to be a little different. You talk about farms destroying wild places and the difference between farming versus foragers. You talk about that a lot.
Yeah, my parents are bird watchers, so I grew up as a kid going on all these trips around the state of Maine to look at different birds and their habitats. My parents were writing a book, A Birdwatcher's Guide to the Coast of Maine. So we would go to the mountains and we would go to, you know, these coastline ecosystems. And they spent a lot of time telling me and my sister about all the different adaptations of birds to their habitats. And they, you know, they all fit perfectly. They worked with the trees around them. They worked with the salt marshes. You know, they had these really carefully fine-tuned relationships. And then we would go home and we would get our food from the grocery store. And I would learn in school that, you know, the industrial farms that produced the food for our grocery store were destroying habitat and wreaking havoc on the climate and the nitrogen cycle and the water cycle. And I don't think I could have articulated it as a kid, but I just thought that was devastating. And I started to wonder, I think, you know, again, subconsciously on a pretty suppressed, deep level, like, what is wrong with us? Why are we the only species that doesn't have a habitat that's so bad? Like, what's wrong with us?
Yeah, it's interesting that you started questioning those things, as did I. I just very different generation and different upcomings. But I really appreciated that. And that a lot of the people that you studied and learned from helped kind of drive your understanding. And the no farms, no food, I call it the big lie of scarcity, that the earth isn't quite capable of feeding all of the people. And that's something that you just keep bringing home to us. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, I think I got that idea from stories that I absorbed as a kid. I don't know if anyone else out there of my generation had an American Girl doll, but I had Kirsten Larson, and I just loved her. I was totally obsessed with her. And she came with these 6 books, and in one of the books, there was a story about her. It's all completely fictional, and I now see there's lots of colonial erasure and falsehood, but I was, you know, 8 or 10 at the time. And there was a story about her friendship with an indigenous girl named Singing Bird. And there was a lot about Singing Bird's people moving west because there was no longer enough food now that this influx of European colonists had arrived. And there's this really line that I think really kind of stuck with me, where they were moving west because you couldn't hunt anymore. Now that all these farmers had come in, and the basic message, which was also in so many other books that I read as a kid, was that hunting and gathering was a less productive way of producing food and only possible for small groups of people living on large tracts of land, and that as populations grew, people were forced to become farmers. And, you know, later on in college, I studied environmental studies. I found that in papers like Jared Diamond's, I think it's titled The Worst Mistake in the History of Humanity, about how agriculture was kind of this terrible mistake, but then as populations grew, it became not optional but necessary. And so that message was just reinforced throughout my whole life. And when I started getting excited about the idea of these tree crops, I kept alternating between like this real excitement and then thinking, oh, but I don't know, it probably doesn't work. There's too many of us, right? We can't do that. They're not productive enough. And so I really started interrogating the yield question and spent several years talking to different people, asking the question in about 1,300 different ways, which is, you know, my mom will tell you since I was little, that's maybe my specialty. And just asking why, or what about this? And what I found after a lot of research is that is just a total garbage lie, not true at all. And in fact, the opposite is true. A monoculture of row crops is basically the least efficient way of producing food that we could come up with. And the idea that that's what we need to do to feed the world is just completely untrue. Mm-hmm. So I go into a lot more detail in the book, but a fully functioning ecosystem will outproduce a monoculture every time.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the other thing about reading your book. I bought a farm, I guess you could say, about 24 years ago. But I never wanted to do it conventionally. I wanted it to be done with community, and I wanted to maintain the environment as much as possible. And that's what we've done. And, you know, it's not, it doesn't look like a lot of the manicured places around. But it's been such a learning, and I've loved it. So I was reading your book and going, oh, so I wasn't wrong. Okay, this is great. And now we have a lot of land where we could be planting these trees. So I got really excited about the possibility. But I want to say that you, part of your learning, you started to, you met up with Mark Shepherd. He's a local hero around here. And you started learning a lot about growing nuts and growing forestry foods. So
yeah, he came and gave a talk out here on Cape Cod. It turns out that one of his oldest friends is a Cape Cod guy, Rand Burkert. And Rand said, hey, my friend Mark has come to do this talk. You should go. And I was freelancing for the paper, so I pitched a story on the talk to them and went. And I had no idea what it was really going to be about, but I trusted Rand. He'd always pointed me in the right direction in the past. And I was just blown away by the talk. I was still kind of living in that old food story with this idea that humans were inherently bad for the environment and our needs were sort of bad, and in meeting them, we had to hurt other species. And right at the outset, he sort of told that story and then said, well, what we're doing is taking fully functional ecosystems where all our needs could be met and destroying them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, wait, what are those fully functioning ecosystems where all our needs can be met? I want to hear more about that. And he spent the next hour describing his farm, New Forest Farm, which I ended up going to visit the following year, a couple years later. And he, at the time I visited, had 139 species of edible perennials. And just this incredible mimicking of an oak savanna ecosystem. So people where you are probably more familiar with the oak savanna ecosystem than where I am. But there's just an incredible bounty of human food species in mm-hmm. that ecosystem. And that's not an accident. I didn't know it when I first started learning, but that's because it is a foodscape that was created by indigenous people over, hundreds, if not thousands of years. So he started describing, chestnuts in the overstory, grapes, asparagus, apples, prunes, plums, mushrooms. And I'm thinking, wait, we have a choice between eating like corn mush and this incredible diet, venison, rabbit. So I was pretty interested right away. And that talk, I left and I walked out into the woods around my house of the Cape Cod National Seashore, which for listeners who don't know is I'm on this sand spit, sticks way out into the Atlantic, and about 70% of our land here is protected as part of the seashore. So I had always seen this forest as an impediment to food production, right? We can't farm, there's no farmland here, we've got no space. And all of a sudden I walked out into the woods and there's oak trees dropping edible acorns, there's blueberries, there's huckleberries. Mm-hmm. It just completely changed the way that I saw the land around me and completely changed, that's sort of the beginning of my shift in my relationship with the place where I live. So that for me was a total light bulb moment and really eye-opening.
Yeah, and that makes me think more about the land that I'm living on. And little by little, through the years, I've just learned about these different things. I mean, I just was smiling because almost everything you mentioned is growing on our 40 acres, and we take advantage of it, and it's wonderful. And I think a lot of people maybe still do not realize what we're sitting on here in the Driftless, that what Mark was able to point to and what some of us are still trying to do by holding on to the land. And the thing I really appreciated was the understanding from your book was the understanding that farming and foraging both still require maintenance, that you have to protect what you're growing,
Really illuminating for me as I researched and wrote. I think I grew up with this idea that farmers and hunter-gatherers were like different evolutionary phases of human development, with hunter-gatherers as people of the past and farmers as modern people who had it all figured out and were making plans. And, you know, the hunter-gatherer wakes up and thinks, like, where am I going to go today to find the nuts and berries? And that turns out to be yet another story written by Euro-American culture, really during the heyday of scientific racism, to as a way of trying to sell this myth of the superiority of Euro-American and European culture and Euro-American food production methods. So, you know, we don't really learn in school, at least I didn't learn in public school, about the extent that Euro-American settler soldiers went to basically declare war on indigenous food systems. You know, if you're trying to take someone else's land, it's a lot easier to take it if those people don't have enough to eat. You know, if you are fighting against a group of people who are healthy and well-fed, and you are this newcomer who really knows nothing about this place, you're probably not going to be very successful. And I think something that was much more open at the time of that sort of imperial expansion and war on indigenous culture was Euro-Americans were purposefully trying to destroy the abundance of indigenous food systems, you know, killing all the bison, trying to wipe out rivers full of fish.
That's a very, you know, we just said that, like killing all the bison, but that was such a systematic and deliberate thing that was done.
Yeah.
It's not even like we can think about it. This actually, you know, it's historically fact.
Yeah, no, and so much resource was poured into destroying these food systems as a way of waging war on indigenous people. And, you know, some historians call it, there's a word for it, they call it a feed fight. And so when we think about, oh, why don't we know about this food, or why aren't we in relationship with these species, we have to talk through that history and we have to reckon with it. And I think that, you know, trying to kind of skip over that or gloss over that doesn't serve any of us. And as the regenerative agriculture conversation gets a little more mainstream, I hope that that is going to be part of the conversation, because I think it's really healing for everyone to recognize it, to acknowledge it, and not to try to move forward without doing that work, if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense to me. Of course, because a lot of my history is tied up with learning from indigenous people. In fact, I studied with a Navajo woman, and one of the first things, when I told her I felt like the need to have land, but I didn't want to buy land. I don't like the whole concept of owning land, you know, especially having been around the Navajo who don't own land. And she said, buy the land and it'll teach you. And so I did, and it is. And so again, a lot of your book resonated with me, especially when you started talking about Ron Reed, the Karuk medicine man, the Fix the World people. Please, let's talk about that. That was a wonderful understanding.
Yeah, Ron is a pretty incredible guy. He is so generous in telling his story and sharing insights from his culture, and has really taught me a lot about the way that he sees the world and that his people see the world. And the contrast of that from how I grew up has really caused me to look back and question a lot of the stories that I grew up with. When we first started talking, it was the pandemic, so we would talk on Zoom, and we had been introduced through Kari Marie Norgaard, who wrote this beautiful book, Acorn and Salmon Feed Our People. And she's a non-native sociologist, and I had reached out to her about her book, and she had put me in touch with Ron. And, you know, I was still kind of living in my story of humans being bad for the earth. And he told me this story right at the beginning. He said, well, Karuk people call ourselves Fix the World people. And in our creation story, humans were put on the earth to create habitat for other species. And the way that we do that is through fire. We light sacred fires, and through those fires, we manage and create habitat for other species. And he was you know, he called the other species kin and relation.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, huh? Like, what are you talking about? I don't totally get this. But the more we talked, the more I started to understand what he was saying. You know, it was kind of like he and I would have these conversations, and then I would kind of go back to my Western science background and see where the pieces fit together, if that makes sense. And what I started to see was he was describing humans using fire in this habitat creation as a keystone species. And I learned about keystone species in school, and you know, beavers create dams, and that makes a wetland. And so they're this category of keystone species known as an ecosystem engineer. And for listeners who don't know, a keystone species just describes the fact that these species are as important to their ecosystems as the keystone in a Roman arch. So if you pull that keystone out, right, the whole system falls apart.
Hmm.
And oaks are a keystone species. And what he was telling me, I started to realize, is that we as habitat creators have also traditionally in cultures that, you know, all over the Northern Hemisphere, in fact, all over the world, humans are ecologically, our biggest role has been to use fire to create habitat. And that's in places as diverse as Australia and the Amazon and England and present day California. And in North America, you know, the way that oaks have stayed dominant on the landscape in a lot of places is through human burning and indigenous fire and cultural fires. And as I got to know Ron and he shared some of his history with me, it was incredibly eye-opening to, you know, at first I was like, okay, well, he's using fire in his place. That makes sense. You know, you always hear California and the wildfires. But slowly over time, I came to see that actually fire in its own way has really also had a relationship with oaks in the place where I live and has helped keep them dominant on the landscape. And that was just such a perspective shift for me. And I ended up being really interested in prescribed fire and getting certified. And so I've now gotten to go on, I think, 6 or 7 burns. And it's just been incredible. I'm so in love with the whole process.
Yeah. Excellent. So I would like to let people know that you're listening to Changing the Narrative. And I'm Dina Eccles, and my guest today is Elspeth Hay, and we're talking about her book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food, and uncovering a lot of history that maybe has been in our way, and taking a look at what we can be doing differently. I really appreciated your observations in this book. One of the ones that I had never heard of was Joseph Henrich. Is that the way to say his name, Henrich?
And I'm not sure. It might be Heinrich.
Heinrich,
something,
yeah, something
in that genre.
Okay, and the word weird.
Yeah.
And it's Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, and that.
Yeah,
just cracked me up.
Well, it turns out that you know, people like me, and it sounds maybe from what you've said so far, people like you, we're weird. We are actually, you know, a lot of the studies in psychology. I'm trying to find his numbers. Okay, so he found that 96% of participants in experimental psychology and human behavior studies were from Northern Europe, North America, or Australia. And when they took studies from a broader range of cultures, it turns out that people from these countries tend to skew really far at one end of this whole spectrum of human behaviors and psychology. So when we say, oh, humans do this or humans do that, that was really just not true. You know, we're talking about weird humans, not all humans. And I think it... For me, seeing that was this eye-opener of, okay, if that's true of our psychology studies, and I'm already seeing how many of our stories that I thought were just fact are actually not fact, they're just cultural stories, I think realizing that opened me up to other ways of seeing and learning. So I really enjoyed his work and found it pretty eye-opening as well.
Yeah, that's great. I'll have to check some more of that out. And that leads us to that understanding of dominant culture, which is another term that I often use, rather than white supremacy, or because it's dominant culture. And our dominant culture has agreed to this story that's been handed to us about food scarcity. A lot of people believe that. This is a real thing, and have for, you know, decades now. And I was happy to see you start to unravel that. And it is an unraveling, because we've all been steeped in this for so long. It just takes time to start thinking differently. But it's wonderful when you get to do it. It's so freeing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think at first when I started looking through the history and seeing how involved Euro-American leadership has been in writing this no farms, no food scarcity story, I was really overcome by these feelings of just like disgust and shame.
Yeah.
But I kept following the thread. I couldn't really put it down. And the further back I went, and it kind of fed that idea, right? Of like, well, what is wrong with us? You know, I would talk to Ron and I would think, why are Ron's people fix the world people and my people are ruin the world people? Like, what is wrong with us? And the further back I went, I ended up finding this history that really was new to me about why we came to North America, why so many Europeans wanted to leave their home and go to a new continent. And as a kid, I always learned, you know, we came here because it was the land of opportunity, right? It was an amazing place. It was full of food. But in fact, you know, maybe 25%, if you look at the numbers of people, came here for economic opportunity. And the other 75% came here because either they were sent as convicts, they were in such debt that they were forced to come here to work for someone else to pay off the debt. They were an indentured servant. And what all those people had in common was they had been forced off their own traditional homelands in Europe. And so there was this internal colonization of Europe known as the enclosures that we don't really talk about as a culture and was really traumatic. Yeah. And it's sort of this big trauma that's been swept under the rug of Euro-American history. It's definitely not something I ever heard about in school. And when I followed it back, it really seemed like that was the start of this no farms, no food story. I ended up going over to England and getting to know these two women who are commoners over there and raise ponies on these common lands. And one of them was telling me about, I'm not going to remember his name right now, but this orator in the 1600s or 1700s. And she was like, oh, you should read his stuff. He talks about how, you know, you can't get people to labor if there's too much food that they can just gather.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and I found this sort of first draft of the no farms, no food story in England, mm-hmm. right at the time when this enclosure movement was happening, when early colonization was beginning. And it was really controversial at the time. You know, people didn't believe it because they had been in relationship with the land for centuries. They knew how productive these spaces were, which people started calling waste spaces, right?
Right.
So the side of the road,
mm-hmm.
The hedgerows, the commons, mm-hmm. these places that had been shared spaces where people could gather nuts, berries, hunt, go fishing. And so there was this really clear moment where the no farms, no food story got written and started being perpetuated and really sent out as this perpetual trauma everywhere that the colonists went, all around the world. And when I started realizing how far back it went and how deep that trauma was, it just made me want to write the story all the more, like, mm-hmm. thinking, okay, if my people were part of writing this story, then I want to unwrite it. I, you know, that's where I want to start in terms of reckoning with this.
Right. And I really appreciated that that you went back. And I loved the section on Appalachia. A lot of my family were from there. And I think understood, much like the Driftless, you know, it's because of the hilliness and stuff, it couldn't be farmed in the same way. And the diversity of people that were in the area, same again, same as here generations back, and how they worked together and shared the land. And then this idea of enclosure really just meant fencing in or fencing out. And then that land ownership. I think that's such an important thing.
Yeah, we tend to, you know, think of our land ownership system that we have now where, you know, there's almost no common land. Things are owned privately, right? And we tend to think of that as the norm, but it's actually pretty recent. I was surprised to learn when I was down in Appalachia, I spent some time with a historian named Ralph Lutz, and he showed me around the former chestnut country of southwestern Virginia. And he kept telling me these things about the animals, you know, who were allowed to just wander free and eat the nuts. And I didn't totally get it at first, but eventually what he explained to me is that historically there, and even still now in some places legally, the law was that it was your responsibility if you had an area of land that you wanted to protect from livestock to fence people's animals out. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, any unimproved land, and unimproved really just meant it didn't have a building or it didn't have row crops planted on it. Unimproved land was a commons. So, you know, there might be landowners in the city who owned 10,000 acres in Appalachia, and they weren't there, and they weren't, you know, necessarily doing anything specific with the land. It had been a king's grant passed down or whatever. And so all of that land was a commons, and the law allowed people to hunt, to gather, to fish, to forage medicine, and to turn livestock out to graze. You know, there's all these stories of pigs fattening up on the mast of chestnuts and acorns and other nuts in the woods. And a lot of people made a living that way. You know, they would bring the nuts into these country stores, which would send them into the cities and make, you know, in some cases, half of their spending money for the whole year from gathering up chestnuts in the fall. And so it was this completely different cultural agreement than the one that we know today. And what happened, not there so much, but in a lot of places, there where Lutz lived, they kind of managed to hold on to the older agreement until quite recently. But after the Civil War, when enslaved people were freed, the trespass laws changed in every southern state within a year. So this arrangement that when African Americans were enslaved allowed slaveholders to really shift part of the burden of feeding enslaved people onto those people themselves, that changed. The power dynamic changed. And when enslaved people could gather what they needed, hunt what they needed, forage what they needed, and already had a really intimate knowledge of the land and could come and go from the labor market as they wanted and as their resources allowed, the white Euro-American planters were not happy with that. And so the commons were very quickly closed down. The laws changed at different rates in different places. And then that spread north and west. And so this tradition of commoning, which early Euro-American immigrants had felt really strongly about because that's what had been taken away from them in Europe, it fell apart again. And we're still dealing with the legacy of that.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I don't know if you know the Boggs, Jimmy Boggs and Grace Lee, but Jimmy was a black man from the South, and he would always say, make a way out of no way. And I was thinking of that as I was reading your book, making a way, because people would, you know, it seemed like not an impossibility, but everything that they needed was there. So make a way out of no way. And I think the other thing that really I loved that you did was understanding that this stealing of the land, really, land theft is what I'm going to call it, was the founding story of capitalism and the economic system that we created. At one point you actually said it's an economic system we created and can most definitely change, and of course I was cheering for you at that moment.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. We talk about the economy like it has all these natural laws, but it's totally made up. We right. made it up.
right.
And the real laws are ecological, mm-hmm. and we're coming to this moment, we're at this moment, where the real laws are really starting to make themselves known, and the made up laws are becoming more and more ridiculous.
I was just going to say, that was the word, ridiculous.
Yeah, they don't make any sense. They're, I'm not even actually going to give them that. I was going to say maybe they made sense in their moment, but I don't actually think they made sense then either. Mm-hmm. They just don't really make sense. And if we want to keep living here, which I think most of us do, we're going to have to rewrite those laws. And I think that if we can, laws are always based on a shared story. They're based on a shared cultural understanding and a cultural agreement. And I think that even just reckoning with how we got here is a really important beginning step of changing those agreements.
Yes, I think you're right on it. And that's one of the reasons when I started reading into your book, I was like, okay, this is going to be an important conversation, and this is an important book, and encourage people. I mean, people have been knowing this, but you've really brought it together in a way that's easy to understand and pretty much undeniable. I mean, your love of acorns did us all a good a good thing.
Thank you.
And I have to say, being half Italian, I totally enjoyed your section on Italy and the chestnuts. That was really lovely.
Yeah, I've been playing a lot with chestnuts recently, having a lot of fun with them.
Western Pennsylvania, we had a lot of chestnuts. I think things are getting a little tougher now to find, but it was something I grew up with and loved very much.
I've been making
go ahead.
I was just gonna say I've been experimenting recently with these savory chestnut crepes with mushrooms and greens and garlic and sauteed roasted chestnuts. Those have been really good, and I've been making crackers and just sort of finding all these new ways to use chestnut flour, and it's been really fun.
Mm. Yeah, our area is filled with black walnuts too, and I was thinking it's a different taste. People are so now accustomed to the basic things that we keep eating over and over and over again, that these different tastes, like I was listening to one of your podcasts about black raspberries. We just cycled through the black raspberries. They're wonderful, wonderfully abundant, currants and a few others. But it's not the same thing. They're not as sweet as what people are used to. So it's going to take a little bit of people trying different things and allowing their taste buds to change.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, especially with something like an acorn that requires some pretty substantial processing, there's also a lot of just cultural knowledge that we lost and forcibly erased, mm-hmm. in the case of indigenous knowledge in present-day North America. And on the one hand, that is really tragic. And on the other hand, there's this really engaging collective work that we need to do to get back into relationship with these trees. And I have had some of the most interesting conversations with acorn people trying out, different processing methods, different cooking methods, different recipes. And it's so fun to talk to people in different places because, of course, when I first started, an acorn is an acorn. Well, no, actually, there's more than, I think, 600 species of oaks, and they all make slightly different acorns. And, you know, some are better for oil, and some are better for flour, and some are really good for producing a lot of starch. At one point, I made this Korean recipe for a dish called dotori mok, where you kind of make like acorn jello, which sounds so strange, but it was so good. You mix together acorn starch and water and salt, and you make this acorn jello and cut it into slices. And then on top, you have julienned carrots and peppers and lettuce and scallions and this like ginger, soy, sesame dressing. And I mean, I never really could have imagined that, but it was so good. And so I think that it's communal work, and yes, it can be really joyful work, right, if we do it together.
Yes, and that's what you used when you talked about the chestnuts in Italy. That was the thing that started to come in, because I was waiting for it. I was reading your book going, okay, let's talk about community, because that was my understanding of creating, we call it Echo Valley Farm, that it would have to be done in community, that a lot of these things we're relearning or learning for the very first time. And it requires everybody to do the piece that they love. You know, like I love the planting and care for trees. I really love that. And my wife likes to cook.
Perfect.
And incredible cook. Okay, yeah, more than perfect. It's amazing. So, yeah, I mean, and then there's other people on the farm. Like this morning we were talking, I was talking about your book. And one of the people living on the farm is a little older and talked about her grandparents and how they talked about coming from Germany because there was no more land. The barons owned all the land. She remembers them telling that story and why they came here. But then again, just as you said, we've then repeated the same things. So it's time to shift on many, many levels.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think we're ready for it.
Yeah.
And I think people are ready.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm thrilled to get to know you, to get to know your story and this and your book. There's a lovely quote, and I don't remember from your book, I don't remember who wrote it, but it said, "Diverse, productive, and abundant ecosystems make free people possible and healthy people possible."
And yes.
Yeah, that
Dale Hendricks.
Who was that?
Dale Hendricks. He's a nurseryman in Downingtown, Pennsylvania. He's a great guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you toured around, and it's good. We'll all benefit from that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And another quote from Robin Wall Kimmerer and Karuk Forester Frank Lake. You said they had written, "Every landscape reflects the history and culture of the people who inhabit it. The worldview of a society is often written more truthfully on the land than in its documents."
Yeah, that's a really beautiful quote.
Yeah.
Very true.
When you begin to see that, then you're very willing to change it, you know, change the way we live on the land, to let it... And the thing that got me probably the most was the caring for the land, you know, how so important that is. I've been lucky, and I'll share with you at another time, but to run into a lot of indigenous people who are, you know, working very hard either on the food production end, you know, and also on the growing and care for it end. And I think it's time that we all know one another and, you know, build this new world.
Yeah, yeah, I've been surprised how, you know, as I've gotten to know different plants on my landscape, it's really felt like I'm meeting them, like getting into a relationship with a new friend. I remember the first time I saw elderberry flowers. I knew they grew locally, but I didn't really know where they were. And I was biking one day and I was like, oh my God, that's them. And then it was like, okay, now I have this new friend. I'm going to stop by and check out the berries. I'm going to stop by in the spring and see what the shoots look like. I'm going to figure out what they like. And it's been like that with so many different plants. And I think maybe partly because my interest started in COVID and there weren't a lot of human happenings at that time. But it is a relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that taking care of the environment is often framed as a sacrifice, but I don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think that we have so much joy and meaning, and there's such a poverty of that in dominant Euro-American culture. And like, if we can get back into relationship with these species, even if we're moving slowly one at a time, you know, just kind of getting to know one species at a time, there's an incredible richness that comes into your life.
And one neighbor at a time. You know, it's yeah. often talked about that the area that I'm from, the road, that the people all shared the same equipment for whenever they had to, and they came and helped one another. And that wasn't all that long ago. That was like in the probably 40s, 50s. And then, the get big or get out, that was the other lie that was told to farmers and to cattle people. Get big or get out. And so a lot of them went to that route. And I think we're suffering so much from that not loving it, just kind of doing it. The industrialized nature of what we're doing has taken away that sense of relationship. And I think it's time, for it to wake up again. Because it is fun. A lot of people say to me, oh, you work so hard. And I'm like, no, wait, what do you do? And then they tell me and I say, that's work. I couldn't drive an hour and go to an office and, do the things you do. I couldn't do that, but I can tend the trees. I can do what I do. So it's not work to me. It's definitely a labor of love. So, and that was another thing that your ending notes. One of the comments was live like we plan to stay. That we kind of, European Americans kind of drifted in, but now we have to live like we plan to stay. And I thought that was an important point.
Yeah, I think if you're living, that was a Robin Wall Kimmerer quote, and I think that we're living like the next, the next generation maybe won't be here. And I think that does come in part from that historical trauma and that sense of like, well, I don't know, we may have to pick up and leave again. Who knows? That may be true. But in the meantime, if we want to have the opportunity to stay, shifting those relationships and, really trying to understand what does this place need to thrive? Oaks, part of what got me so excited about oaks is that they're this keystone species, right? So if you're supporting oaks and you're creating habitat for oaks, then by extension, you're also creating habitat for countless other species, all these insects, birds. And I think that supporting life in that way is the pathway to, to a successful and joyful tomorrow. And so now I've just been, it's interesting, I've been doing some interviews with people in Australia, and I think, I don't know, these trees aren't native there. I don't really know much about that ecosystem. But really, if we're figuring out what the keystone species are in our ecosystem where we live, whether that's a wetland or a forest or a prairie, whatever that ecosystem is, if we're finding ways to support those keystone species, then I think we're doing our job.
Agreed. Yes. So anything that you'd like to add? Any last things that you'd like to say?
I think the only thing that came up when you were just talking a little bit before about everyone having their niche and everyone having something to offer, I think that's a really beautiful way to look at it. One of the things that surprised me when I got into acorns and nut trees is that I've ended up becoming obsessed with basketry. And I just would have never expected that. I didn't see it coming. On one of my trips out to present-day California, a Kurok woman, a friend of Ron Reed's, Kathy McCovey, showed me these hazelnut baskets that she had made in the traditional Kurok style. And I came home and I thought, I want to learn how to make hazelnut baskets. Those were so cool and I'm so into these nuts. And I couldn't find a hazelnut basket class, and I ended up finding this willow basketry class. And it's turned out to be this whole other portal into the relationship between my ancestors and plants. And so I guess I just would say to people, you know, just let it lead you. Let the work lead you where it wants to take you. And I think that we can all find our right spot in trying to put together this puzzle.
Right. I love that. That's beautiful. Be a weaver. I think that's a really important thing. So I'd like to thank everyone for listening to Changing the Narrative. And I'm Dina Eccles. And my guest, Elspeth Hay, has, I think, done a really snap job on her new book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. And I highly recommend it. It's just come out, right? I think just a little bit ago here. So grab it, guys, and maybe she'll come back through and to the Driftless. She's been here before, and maybe come back through and we could share stories and food and acorns together.
I'd love that.
So thanks to everybody listening in. Thank you, Elspeth. Thanks to WDRT for giving us this opportunity, and thanks to my engineer, Kelly Kopisch. So enjoy, everybody, and get back out there and look at the beauty that we have, and how can we regain that relationship to the earth and to one another. So thank you.